Well, it's time now for part two of a three-part interview I conducted with Professor Mark Swilling, the academic who spearheaded the report, The Betrayal of the Promise, which, along with the Gupta Leaks and the South African Council of Churches unburdening panel, sought to put an end to state capture. Well, we ended last night with the professor expressing his complete and utter disappointment that the whole idea of the developmental state had been repurposed for nefarious ends, and that this is perhaps amongst all of the issues around state capture, the greatest tragedy of the last 10 years, that what could potentially be a successful and country-changing model has most likely been fatally wounded.
So, I mean, just going back to the pre-1990 debates about the democratic developmental state, knowing this is maybe impossible, the Mbeki era, while I was trying to build up a public policy school with a progressive view of a more interventionist state and policy moving in the opposite direction. And then the Polokwane movement, which in theory was delivering quite a good idea, but in practice gets fundamentally compromised, and in the process discredits the idea of a developmental state. So I think the reason why the focus of the discussion about state capture was about corruption only is that it created a comfort zone, because a subtext for many in business and so on was, well, this is, you know, the solution is to get the state the hell out of the way, and we can go back and make market economics work. That's not going to work. And so we've made our lives much more difficult now. We actually have to rescue the idea of the possibility of a well-run, minimally corrupt, interventionist state that is committed to development and is still democratic. What we have taken on as South Africans, and I've been aware of this for a very long time, I've tried to write about it, is maybe impossible. I don't know. We really have a huge challenge. And one of my real disappointments at the moment is there's no evidence that the Ramaphosa government is taking economic policy seriously. They're so fundamentally challenged with the need to restructure state institutions, state-owned enterprises, with the right guy to do the job. But the big picture is not being put in place.
As you said, a very difficult project, considering we're doing this in a democratic state. We don't have the the autocratic hand of a Lee Kuan Yew and the the miracle on the hand of South Korea. And being mindful of the window of opportunity, as you say, that may have quite firmly shut because it was so subverted. When you look at the key challenges now facing, I actually don't want to get ahead of myself. I want to circle back to that question before we get into a way forward, Mark. So you are building the center over at WITS. You then, from 2003 onwards, your research and your teaching has tended to focus on sustainable resource use. And you make special reference to transitions at urban, national and global levels. Now, we're currently in a situation in South Africa where the land debate is firmly on the table, and urbanization is a key component of that. And what this means from a demand perspective, a demand for housing, access to opportunities, work opportunities close to where people live, all of those things coming together in quite a heady brew with the Constitutional Review Committee investigating whether or not Section 25 of the Constitution needs to be adjusted. From your perspective, having studied transitions in urban settings, what would you like to see happen from here?
Just to back up a little bit to the first part of your question, which is this shift towards sustainability that happened to me. At a personal level, I was very, very involved in the negotiations to integrate all the different parts of Johannesburg into one metropolitan government. And that started with the Soweto rent boycott. Cyril Ramaphosa was the leader of the Soweto People's Delegation, and I was one of the advisors to him and Frank Chikane and Desmond Tutu and Master Sulu, etc., who were leading that process during the transition from 89 onwards. And I spent 3 or 4 years deeply entrenched in the microdynamics of reassembling Johannesburg into a integrated metropolitan government. And one of the things I became obsessed with was the water and sanitation system, because I realized that's where the bulk of the money is. And as I got closer and closer to it, I realized that the sanitation system was this interface with the natural system. And during the apartheid years, where we couldn't access industrial chemicals, we became one of the world leaders in the natural treatment of sewage using natural methods. And I became so interested in this and realized that my whole education had not equipped me to understand the interface between social systems and natural systems. And these giant creatures that through oxygenation we'd created in our sanitation treatment system in Johannesburg to munch up the shit before it goes into the rivers. And this was so interesting. It started to percolate my mind. I then also, in teaching public policy, I realized reductionism doesn't work. Marxism doesn't work, because Marxism is great at critique. It delivers nothing when it comes to solutions. Mm. And so my Marxism basically dissipated as I became more and more involved in the negotiations and building a policy school. And I turned to complexity theory, systems thinking and complexity theory. And that's when I discovered that there is a conceptual framework, complex adaptive systems, that explains both the workings of natural systems and the workings of social systems. And that becomes the connection. That becomes, you know, that's my Damascus Road experience. And I start introducing that into the public policy school at WITS, and then realize I have to break away and devote the rest of my life to this idea. And that really was the entry point into complexity in the late 90s. And then my wife and I, Eve Annika and I, who worked together at the public policy school, left Johannesburg, went to Stellenbosch. The Enthoven family, Dick Enthoven and Adrian Enthoven, helped set us up. And eventually we set up the Sustainability Institute, which then got incorporated in Stellenbosch University. And yeah, that was 15, 16 years ago. So I've always been interested in cities. And as I became interested in complexity, I realized cities are the archetypal complex adaptive system.
Mm.
And with a majority urban world, how those systems transition to more sustainable use of resources will actually drive the global transition. And that's why I'm in Yale now. I'm writing a book about that, in part. So to answer your question about land, the land question in South Africa has, since 94, unfortunately been depicted almost exclusively as a rural land question. Redistribution of rural agricultural farmland. But apartheid was pretty unique in the sense that it was also an urban land. It was also about the racialization of urban land via the Group Areas Act. And part of that involved extensive state intervention in land ownership within South African cities via Transnet and so on. And so we have, because of the general perception that land question is a rural question, we've neglected urban land. And because we've neglected interventions in urban land, we've actually sunk in concrete the apartheid city by putting the poor onto the peripheries. And so the rise in urban land invasions is really a response. That's what we're seeing all over the place now, is really a response to the consequences of the failure to address the urban land question. And now we're going to have to be, if we really want to deal with this and prevent a ring of fire building up around the peripheries of our cities, we really are going to have to face the need, like Brazil and other countries, to intervene in the urban land question. And state-owned land is actually very strategically placed. Look at the railway yards and so on in Cape Town. Unused, vast areas of unused land owned by parastatals in many places is a really very strategic and important asset.
And it is within our power, therefore, to be able to respond appropriately. In many of our metros are at least not as constrained as the Cape Metro is from a geography perspective. We do have the states having access to land that can be repurposed. We look at Johannesburg and the vast areas around Johannesburg that are state-owned as well that can be repurposed. But from the perspective of where you would like to see the land debate go from here, are you satisfied considering that we are seeing small experiments, the likes of Premier David Makura's decision to parcel out land to people to develop off their own bat, so to speak, with the government providing some help, some underground infrastructure, but not giving out RDP homes, saying to these individuals, here's the land, you really need to go out and develop a do-it-yourself strategy.
One of the biggest debates globally in the discussion about creative responses to urbanization, rapid urbanization, because the choice is quite stark and difficult. In the context of limited resources, do you do the decent thing and make sure people have land and housing and services? And if so, not many people are going to benefit. Or do you make available land and services to a large number of people and let them encourage and support them to do the rest? But what they don't get is houses. So either choice, you're damned in many ways. The one is not enough people benefit. The other is you're seen not to be delivering enough. So quite often the choice does tend towards the second. Go wide is what it's referred to. Go wide, deliver land and services and support people with the housing process. That can only really work if the land is correctly located. If that land is on the periphery, then you will end up doing what we've done, which is to massively increase the subsidies to the buses and transport to bring them back into the city to work. It's much better to take the money you're spending on transport to actually get good accessible land close to places of work, services, agglomerations. So if you're going to do what David Makura is doing, make sure that the land you're selecting to do that on is appropriately located. Otherwise, you basically sink in concrete with the help of the people's sweat equity, the apartheid city.
But as you so neatly summed up, I think Captain Yasarian's catch-22 there for government, a very difficult situation with which it is confronted. And then we can overlay the fact that there are many who fall into the missing middle, so to speak. If you earn below 3,000 rand a month, you get an RDP home. You may have to wait a long time, or a new build house. If you earn above 3 to 50, you're almost in that missing middle and you can't afford a mortgage bond, but you're not poor enough to get state assistance. So a very difficult challenge for government, which takes us to a few years ago. I'm guessing here a few years ago, because you released the Betrayal of the Promise report last year, detailing the silent coup, as you called it. And also, I think, very neatly demonstrating why the need for this judicial inquiry that we now have and criminal prosecution for corruption and fraud and money laundering and racketeering and possibly even treason. We don't know how far this will go. That was around May of 2017, and there's been a lot of public information and media coverage about the surface of the report, but not much about your experience. And I'd like you to tell your story about how you came to firstly convene the State Capacity Research Project, how that was founded, and who approached you to do such a labor in the face of, as I said in my introduction, some pretty powerful political forces that were intent on building this culture of fear, this climate of fear that was a prerequisite. Yeah. So it was a courageous decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite amazing to think it's just over a year ago. I mean, you know, that is really a stunning thought. You know, if I think back to February, March 27, that felt like the late 1980s. It was those were really frightening times. And to think it's only just over a year ago. And then we South Africans throw up our hands in despair. Oh, yeah. When we don't realize how quickly things can change. You know, it's really, I think, very inspiring. Anyway, that said, to go back to your question, you know, I mean, by early 2017, I had spent more or less almost 10 years not thinking about South African governance. I sunk myself into the sustainability world. I was becoming increasingly involved internationally in international policy research processes via the International Resource Panel, which I joined in 2007, and other fora. And, you know, I obviously was still interested totally interested in the South African dome, but I'd stopped teaching South African economics, I'd stopped teaching South African politics, I'd stopped reading many of the texts that were coming out after, you know, in the early 2000s. It was really, you know, it's actually quite surprising when I think about it. And then what happened in March, Luisi Jonas and I were on an aeroplane together, and we were sitting in business class on opposite ends of the opposite sides of the aisle, and we got talking because we knew each other. And he gave me his iPad. He said, "Read this." And I read a paper that he had written with others from the Treasury, which was essentially, I can't remember what it was called, but it had a very dark name. It was something like the threats to the democratic state or something like that. And I was really surprised. And I read through this thing and I just went into a cold sweat. I mean, here was the Deputy Minister of Finance giving me a paper he had written that was effectively saying the state had been captured by an elite that had betrayed the ANC. And we got talking, and he said, give me your number and I'll contact you. And basically, and I thought, like what often happens in business class on airplanes, you meet people and say, yeah, they have a nice chat. And they say, give me a number and I'll contact you, especially, you know, comrades from the past. And he did. I think it was a week later. Said he's coming to see me at my institute. And he arrived in his government limo. And I noticed he gave his phone to the driver. We walked into my institute and we spent 2 hours where he just poured his heart out and told me, you know, recently there was a film called The Sum of All Fears.
Yes.
That's it. That was the conversation. It was The Sum of All Fears. And at the end, I was sitting there. I didn't know whether I could take notes. I don't know whether I could record it. I don't know whether I'm just asking any questions. I had no idea what the hell was going on. And, you know, it was stuff that I just would have loved to take notes on. And then I said, so, you know, why are you here? What, you know, and his style of leadership is it's not directive. You know, so, you know, I knew that from the past. He sets a context and allows you to make a suggestion, and then he supports that. That's his leadership style. And so I said, why are you here? And he said, well, I said, no, I'm just back talking and then just, you know, sharing where we are and what's happening with us. And I said, but, you know, this needs to come out into the, you know, the story needs to be told. And he said, yes. He says, from our point of view, use the word our. From our point of view, the problem is that the story is about corruption. But actually, what's really going on is not just about corruption. It's a systemic challenge. And I said, well, you know, you need a group of academics that takes this up and brings it into the public domain. And he said, yeah, we need that. I said, well, I can do that for you. And he said, but we don't have any funds. I said, you don't need the funds. I'll raise the funds. So that's basically how it began. And we're bringing out a book in the next month or two called The Shadow State, and it includes a preface that tells the story. Basically, what then happens is I contact Ivor Chipkin at WITS.
Yes.
And we had to talk via an app called Signal and in kind of code, and he basically said he's in. And then I approached the others. I did approach quite a few others who said no, they can't see themselves participating in this. So the group that did participate was a group I'd never worked with before. I'd never worked with Ivor Chipkin either. And it came together, gelled remarkably. And BC had said to me, you've got to bring this report out in 2 months. And I said to him, it's impossible. Basically, that's what we did. We pulled it off. So literally from the cabinet reshuffle, so we started talking before the cabinet reshuffle on the 31st of March, probably a week or two before that. And the report was going to be in defense of the leadership, PG and BC Jonas and others who were going to get nailed. Then the cabinet reshuffle happened, and I had to meet with him and say, so now what's the agenda now? If it's not to defend you guys, what's the agenda? And his response was, the report should support the build-up of a broad societal popular front that's going to take on state capture. And that became the orientation of the report. We did bring it out in 2 months, much to my surprise, with an extraordinary amount of data and information pulled together. Some of it, quite a lot of it new. And it did lead right towards the end to an engagement with the South African Council of Churches, who had their own unburdening panel, what they called their unburdening panel, where they made available to the churches a facility, through the churches, a facility to church members to come and confess they had been compromised by state capture. And a lot of people came forward to compromise. And what the church did, they gave people, I think it was 4 options under which conditions they came and confessed. And the one option was what their confession could be public. And they genuinely did think most people would select that. But the fourth option, I can't remember the other two, the fourth option was totally confidential. And most people selected, surprise, surprise, the fourth option. So they had this huge quantity, massive files on what people had been forced into, you know, corrupt practices that contradicted their conscience as Christians. But the church could do nothing with it. Imagine that, eh?
But you,
they could do nothing.
But you, in the report, say that there was significant confirmation from that unburdening panel report.
But we never saw any of that evidence.
Did you not see any of that?
Oh. No. The only people who had that, who could see the evidence, were the actual, you know, people like the bishop, Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches. So they had this problem. They had committed themselves to a public event where they would reveal the findings of the unburdening panel, but they couldn't. So when with the Archbishop in Cape Town and Frank Chikane and a whole bunch of other bishops and priests and so on, we met with them, and they said, you know, your report confirms what we know, but we can't use any of our evidence. You've got the evidence from other sources. For us, that was hugely significant, because we had the Gupta leaks hadn't come out yet. We really had no idea then, at that moment in time, that the triangulations and the connections that we made on based on a whole range of different bits of pieces of information were actually correct. We're pretty certain, but we had no external confirmation of that, and no peer reviewers or anything like that. So this was the most ideal form of, if you like, external confirmation from people sitting on a huge pile of empirical information, none of which they could give us.
A political peer review, if you like. If you look back,
political peer review. Yeah, I mean, actually, it's not true. There was some stuff that was where confessors had said could be used. So there was bits and pieces that we got, but on the whole, not much. The other big piece of external evidence was the court case involving Eric Woods's, what's it called, Trillion. There was a court that Budlander had initiated on Tokyo Sitkwali's request, an investigation into Trillion. And there was public domain information from court cases that Jeff had that he could give us. And that just saved us going to the court to get the documents, even if it's, you know, assuming they're still there. So we had big files. But that was really one of the very few pieces of independent information, confirmation of what was going on. So the church process was, so the church said, okay, we have this public event. Can we use your information for our public event? And we kind of naively said yes. And they, our lawyer, a few days before the event said, you cannot go with this report into the public domain. You're going to get massively sued for defamation. And you have to reword almost every sentence to say that you are relying on reported evidence that you yourself have not checked. And if you can just rephrase everything that way, you're going to be fine. You can still say exactly the same thing, but it's just the way you formulate the sentence.
Right.
So that was going to take us another week. So the South African Council of Church event happened. They claimed to have a report. They didn't have a report, but the press reported it as releasing the Council of Churches report. It's everything that they knew, but they could cite our research as evidence. Our report was then released a week later at WITS, at the WITS School of Governance, in an auditorium that I was involved in building, which was really nice. We released our report on that Thursday night, a week later, and the next day the Gupta leaks broke.
Do you think the two are connected? And, you know, Mark, I must say, on a personal level, I'll never forget that that week, because that was the week my second daughter was born. And I remember having a conversation with, I think it was the anaesthetist in the operating theatre, because my wife had a C-section. So I'll never forget feeling like this was a seminal moment. Everyone was talking about it because it all happened within that span of a week.
We had
the so-called unburdening panel report, and then your report, and then the Gupta leaks. But do you think there was a connection?
There was no connection between us and the individual who secured access to the Gupta leaks. He secured access to the Gupta leaks and, as you know, over the weekend, gave it to the press. And there was huge panic amongst, you know, Bungani people, et cetera, about what's going to happen to them, you know, possessing this. It was offered to us as well. And I instructed the people that I was working with who were offered it, I said, don't touch it. I was one of them. I said, here's the flash disk. Just look at it. I said, no, I don't want to look at this, because if I'm on television or anywhere and I'm being interviewed about whether I've seen this information and a trained intelligence officer is watching me, he will know I'm lying if I said, I haven't seen it. I want to be able to honestly say I have not seen that information, because that's my best form of protection. I actually said that to my colleagues at that time. Imagine the atmosphere.
Wow.
That you say something like that. You actually say something to your colleague, I'm not going to look at this treasure trove of data because I want to protect myself. When I'm asked and a trained intelligence officer looks at my eyes and knows whether I'm telling the truth or not. If he thinks I'm lying, I genuinely thought then I would be a target.
It's stunning. That is absolutely stunning.
I don't want to see it. I said, I don't want to see it. And they said, well, what happens if it's got stuff that contradicts our evidence? So that's the chance we take.
So be it.
Not a single thing has come out of the Gupta leaks that contradicts anything we've said.
That was part two of a three-part interview I conducted with Professor Mark Swilling. He's the academic who spearheaded the report, The Betrayal of the Promise, and we'll conclude tomorrow with part three. So be sure to tune in to that one. Let's cross now to Arabile Gumede to find out what's in store for tomorrow on Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Mr. G.
Hi, Michael. Well, tomorrow's show is, as usual, jam-packed. The World Bank's global growth outlook has come out, and we'll chat to Lulu Krugel about that. She's chief economist at PwC. Why South Africa will find it very hard to break free from its vicious teaching cycle. We'll chat to Natasha Robinson from the University of Oxford. Also, a cappuccino with the CEOs, with Preven Reddy, the CEO of Kagiso Interactive, and another bumpy ride for the South African currency in 2019. Let's chat to Peregrine Treasury Solutions. All that and more between 7 and 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Well, that's all we have for you on Classic Business tonight. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks to sound engineer Mdu Tele and producer Andres Mashlangu. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Classic1027, at Fine Music Radio and Michael J. Avery, or just follow the hashtag Classic Business, and be sure to download the podcasts on Iono. They're available pretty much on both of the Classic and Fine Music Radio websites. Kianetse Makutu in the lounge for our Cape Town listeners. Congrats on the nuptials, Kianetse. And in Gauteng, Carolyn Staines, Classic Cocktails is said to take the edge off your day if it's like mine. Been a crazy first day back at school. Till tomorrow, good night.